In the Canadian justice system, animals' interests are rarely represented, but the lawyers at Animal Justice fight to give them a voice in court and the political system. This is the Paw and Order Podcast, and these are their stories.
All right, hello everybody. Welcome to episode 4, Paw and Order. Hey Camille, how you doing?
Hey Peter, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. It feels like it's been a month since we did this. I know we had episodes come out, but gosh, it feels like a long time.
Well, that's because it almost has been a month. The last one that we recorded was the live Q&A episode in your class at the University of Alberta.
Should we come clean? For our listeners, those were coming out every 2 weeks. We recorded them both on the same day, I believe, and as a result, it's been over a month since we've had a chance to talk. So, Camille, it's so good to be back. How have you been doing?
I've been pretty good. I was on a kind of a big Western speaking tour, which included a stop in Calgary to visit my dad. And then I went up to see you in Edmonton and spoke in your animal law class.
Let's be honest, Camille, that was the highlight of the whole trip, wasn't it?
Oh, obviously, Peter. We went to a great restaurant, too, called Padmanati, which if any of you are from Edmonton and you haven't been already, you definitely should go. Got amazing vegan food.
We are very happy to shout out Padmanati at just about every opportunity. Great restaurant, gate. Oh, and I have to tell you a surprise. This is totally out of the blue because I'd forgotten about this, Camille. Do you remember when you went to Padmanati? One of the wonderful things about Padmanati is that they believe in embracing their customers. So as you know, Camille knows, like, we are virtually family members at Padmanati. My kids have been growing up there and they love the whole family who runs the place. And the entire restaurant is decorated with pictures. Do you remember that? Of like customers who are special to the place?
Yeah, it's really sweet, actually. It just sort of makes it feel like one big, warm, cozy family.
It sure does. And I have been bitter for the past 6 years that they literally did the photo shoot before we moved to Edmonton. Like, they finished it that month. Like, we arrived and they finished the photo shoot. So we have been unable to get a place on the wall. But I was just notified that they're doing a new photo shoot and we've been invited back. So our pictures are going up on the wall at Padmanati and I couldn't be more delighted. This has been like a life's highlight goal.
Wow. Sounds like everything's turning up in your favor lately. That's kind of exciting.
It's all happening.
Wow.
Anyway, sorry, I interrupted your trip. I just didn't want to forget that little nugget.
The trip was great. After Edmonton, I flew out to Kamloops and I spoke in law professor Katie Sykes's class. She teaches animal law there and she's fantastic. And she's at Thompson Rivers University. And there's such a really strong contingent of animal law folks there for a very small and new school. It's really, really impressive. So that was fun. And after that, I was in Vancouver for a Canadian Bar Association one-day conference. It was held in conjunction with the American Bar Association's biannual conference. For some reason, the ABA keeps coming up to Canada for their events. Every few years they do. And so they had a lot of animal law people in town because they've got a very active animal law committee through the ABA. So the CBA and a great lawyer out there named Rebecca Redder, they teamed up and they held a really fun one-day conference sort of focused on companion animal law. So I spoke about criminal code issues affecting companion animals and delved into some of the cases we did. And
very nice. I was hoping to go to that conference, but I unfortunately had some other things pop up that weekend. But anyway, yes. And from there, I know you went to Denver.
Yeah, the last stop was Denver, and I went and spoke at a really fun symposium. It was put on by the Law Review at the University of Denver, Sturm College of Law. There's a great animal law prof there named Justin Marceau, who does a lot of really interesting cases, including most of the egg-gag cases, where those laws in the states that criminalize undercover investigations. And he's been instrumental in striking down a lot of those laws. So some of his students put on this great conference, and it was just filled with really interesting presentations. So I spoke about some of the aquarium work that we are doing up in Canada.
Fantastic. Sounds like it was a wild time.
Yeah. And I know you had a trip as well, Peter.
It's been very busy here at the home office in Edmonton. I have been traveling a bit. This has nothing to do with animal law, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. I participated with some students a couple of weeks ago. I am the coach of Alberta's Gale Cup Law Team. That is a competitive moot for the non-lawyers amongst you that brings together all of Canada's law schools over a criminal law problem. And they moot in front of some of the country's top judges, including a Supreme Court judge. It's a very big competition. It's very prestigious. It's a lot of fun. And I have been trying to win this thing for like 22 years since I was a law student. And we unsuccessfully competed in the Gale Cup way back in 1996. And I am thrilled, delighted, and overjoyed to report that after five or six attempts, we finally won the Gale Cup this year. The first time Alberta's won since 2001. And it was freaking amazing. Honestly, one of the highlights of my career. We had an absolute blast. It was fun to win. It was fun to compete. And of course, we partied late into the evening after that happened. We even drank out of the cup like it was the Stanley Cup. It was very exciting.
Wow. Well, congratulations. That sounds pretty epic. And
it was. It was amazing.
What was the problem about this year? And I should just mention, for those who aren't familiar with this whole concept of a moot is basically a fake appeal. You take a fact pattern, you take a case, and you sort of argue it and pretend like you're the actual lawyers arguing it in court in front of sometimes real judges and sometimes really impressive other lawyers. But
these were all before judges, and the problem was a problem involving an illegal search and seizure and the obtaining of evidence involving a drugs and weapons case. And it was a really good problem, and it was a lot of fun to do, and we had great support throughout, and I had a great group of students. I'm going to shout them out here just, you know, in case they're listening. The winning team was Heather Cave and Kritika Sharma, and my respondent team was Sarah Frady and Daniel Jackna. A really good group of people, and it was just so much fun. And of course, my good friend Mandy McLeod, who you've met before, she was our coach. She actually runs, she helps run animal cruelty to bring this back to animal issues. She runs animal cruelty prosecutions over in Edmonton on behalf of Alberta Justice. So it was really an amazing thing to win, and it was a lot of fun. And it sort of capped off a bucket list item that I have been wanting to do. And it was just great fun to win. And after that, we went on vacation because I needed a vacation after that. And I went with my family. We went to Las Vegas for a couple of days, which was a really incredible trip. And we had a great time, did all kinds of fun stuff there. And I got to tell you, Camille, the food in Las Vegas is amazing. I'm going to talk a little bit about the food. We've had the odd complaint that I speak too much about the food, but we've also had, you know, listeners, if you like hearing about the food a little bit, let me know, because every once in a while I like to talk about the food, just because
we're just such huge fans of vegan food that you guys are just going to have to get used to it, because we're going to keep talking about it.
Yeah, it's just the way it is. Like, I want to have some fun and talk with my friend Camille about what's going on in my life, and veganism is a big part of my life, and it's always eye-opening to go out to the U.S. because the U.S. gets the vegan food first. So I got to experiment with all of Ben & Jerry's new flavors and Häagen-Dazs. Have you tried the Häagen-Dazs?
No.
Yeah, Häagen-Dazs has a non-dairy. The one I had was like a chocolate brownie flavor, and it was really good. Like, it's probably my favorite one now so far, although I'm a big fan of the Ben & Jerry's too. So Ben & Jerry's is up to like seven or eight non-dairy flavors. And so that was like super exciting. And of course, I got to try the Impossible Burger, which doesn't seem to exist in Canada yet.
Not yet.
Have you had the Impossible Burger?
I tried it in New York.
Oh, the Impossible Burger was great.
Yeah, it's really good. It's sort of like, I don't know, it's like the meatiest vegetarian thing I've probably ever tasted. And it's designed to be just like a beef burger. And it's actually creepy how much it's like beef.
Yeah.
The last time I had beef, I don't even know when that was. I would have been like 13 or something. But
it is all over Las Vegas. I mean, Las Vegas has some of the country's best restaurants. So every restaurant we went into there had an Impossible Burger on the menu.
Wow.
Which was pretty incredible. And I had at least four. I had at least four of them.
Oh my God.
And they were just, they were so good. I couldn't help it. I got to be honest, like, people don't always think of Las Vegas as a vegan destination, but I sure do, because I mean, some of the best restaurants there, they all tend to cater to, you know, celebrities, and celebrities eat a lot of vegan food. So you get a lot of places like the Wynn and Encore Resort Casinos. What's amazing about the Wynn and the Encore is that, they all have specific vegan menus. So you can walk into any of those best restaurants and you can say, well, I want the vegan menu. So we were eating at some incredible fine dining restaurants and like getting these amazing vegan menus, including the Impossible Burger. So that was just great. That was really lovely.
Well, the owner of the Wynn Casino, Steve Wynn, he's vegan himself, from what I understand. So he just decided, well, of course, I'm going to have a vegan menu in my casino. And it makes so much sense.
Steve Wynn, who was like, you know, I loved him for that, but he's run in, as it turns out, into some Me Too problems. So I love him a lot less, although yeah. I still appreciate the vegan menus. But I have to say, the highlight of my Las Vegas experience, I found the best donut place in the US. Ooh. And I have to tell you what's crazy. I am very partial to Voodoo Donuts in Portland, Oregon. And everybody knows about that. Everybody who's been to Portland, who's vegan, knows about Voodoo Donuts, amazing donuts, blah, blah, blah. And like, I've heard about that. And then I started one day, I was on Happy Cow. For those of you who don't know, Happy Cow is a website that lists all the vegetarian and vegan restaurants in the world, believe it or not. And so I was there one day and I saw this place called Roland's Donuts in Las Vegas. And I'm like, oh, a donut place. Great. And then I started reading the reviews, and like each review was more orgasmic than the one before, and they even referenced Voodoo Donuts and were like, this place is better. And I'm like, no way, like I refuse to believe that, but I was intrigued. So then we went this time, Camille, and I sent Camille a picture of our donut extravaganza. They don't have quite as many frosted varietals. In fact, they don't have any vegan frosted varietals, and they're not quite as pretty looking as Voodoo Donuts, and frankly, I don't care. Like, these donuts were the best donuts I've ever had. Like, they were just ridiculously good. And my family scarfed through like 8 donuts in like 10 minutes. It was like really unbelievable. So I have to give a shout out and a warning to anybody who goes out to Las Vegas. You've got to visit Roland's Donuts. It's a little bit out of town. Well worth the trip.
Wow. Well, I still haven't been to Vegas, but that definitely makes me want to make the trek. I will travel very far for vegan donuts. I don't think there are any in Ottawa right now, at least not the fried ones. So sounds very good.
And the fried makes a big difference. Like, I like vegan cake donuts, but yeah. I don't get excited about them. Yeah. We have a couple here. And yeah, I'm with you. Let's just stop talking about donuts. Okay. That's all the fun things we've been doing. But there's been some really amazing, interesting, well, not all amazing, some of them amazing, some less amazing things in the news, Camille. And we want to talk about them before getting into our main topic of the day. We have some bad news to report involving a case that's been very close to animal justice's heart. And that is the case involving the Chatham dogfighting charges. What can you tell us about that, Camille?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of people will remember that over 2 years ago now, there was a huge dog fighting ring bust in southwestern Ontario near Chatham. And the police and the OSPCA, they seized about 31 dogs. They charged a number of people with dozens and dozens of animal cruelty offenses involving dog fighting and dog fighting equipment, of I believe firearms and drugs offenses as well. So there was a pretty significant, you know, network uncovered. The 31 dogs were seized and they were taken in by the animal welfare authorities. The OSPCA later applied to kill 21 of them in court. So they were asking a judge to put 21 of these dogs down on the grounds that they were pit bulls, which are banned in Ontario, and that they were very dangerous. So when we heard that, we kind of thought, well, this isn't right. You know, you've got, on the one side of the case here, you've got the accused people who are accused of horrific cruelty offenses. And then on the other side, you've got the animal welfare authorities who are supposed to protect the dogs, but in this case, want to kill them. So we tried to intervene in that case, and ultimately the court didn't let us, but there was a pretty good outcome reached. Almost all of the dogs were reassessed, and they were determined to be not as dangerous as it was initially alleged. So most of them went to a sanctuary in Florida for rehab. So that was good. And it's been kind of quiet for a little while on this case, but we got the really unfortunate news just a couple weeks ago, that the charges had been dismissed in the case. It had actually been stayed for delay. The case had taken almost 31 months to get to trial after the charges were laid. And under Canadian law, people have a charter, a constitutional right to have a trial on charges within a reasonable time. And that reasonable time frame is about 30 months, barring any huge complications. So these guys were just over the limit. And the result of that, the judge said he was going to stay the 67 charges, including those dogfighting and animal cruelty charges. So that was a huge disappointment. It's
disappointing because it's so rare that we get cases that are that rich and there's such a good evidentiary framework to try. But of course, we should point out that animal charges, these weren't singled out in any way. This is sort of what's been going on in Canada for a variety of charges. Anyone is in danger of having charges stayed at this point.
Yeah, the Supreme Court came out with a new decision called Jordan not too long ago. And as a result, some pretty serious charges, including even murder charges, have been stayed on that basis. So it's not singling out animal charges, but it's a really unfortunate result because what ends up happening in this case is these two men who had their charges stayed, they're going to walk away with no criminal record and, more importantly, no prohibition on owning animals in the future. So theoretically, they can get right back into the game.
Yeah, and that's why, again, it's hard to say that this is more egregious and more problematic than any charge that is stayed for any types of serious delay. It's just more unfortunate for animal cases because these types of cases don't come along as often. They're not investigated as thoroughly. The SPCA that investigates them doesn't have the resources to go after offender after offender. So when you lose one of the precious charges that comes out, especially with offending as serious as this one, it's disappointing simply because we don't get to pursue a case that really needs that type of attention.
Yeah, yeah. So pretty sad outcome. But Peter, there is some kind of interesting positive news across the pond in the UK.
Yeah, let's talk something positive, Camille. Aside from donuts, I need some good news, yeah.
We all need some good news.
Yeah, that news is, this just came out very recently and we wanted to give it a little shout out and some love, was it really also as a contrast to where we stand here in Canada, that the Labour opposition party in the UK recently released an animal welfare plan. And they even state in this plan for animal welfare that Labour has always placed the welfare of animals high on the policy agenda and actually released. I know, Camille, for those of us in Canada, it's sort of staggering to think of the idea of a political party actually releasing an animal welfare policy with this much detail. But that's what they did in the UK. Have you had a chance to look at it at all, Camille?
Yeah, I took a look and, you know, they're doing some really common sense things there, including, I believe, Peter, an animal welfare commissioner or some official who would be tasked with examining these issues, which would be a huge benefit.
I mean, what a radical, crazy idea, Camille, eh? Like this idea that we're going to put together somebody who is independent and has no self-interest in actually, I mean, you know, in Canada, I don't know about you, Camille, but I feel good about the fact that it's the Ministry of Agriculture that is looking after the interests of animals. Don't you? Doesn't that make you feel warm and fuzzy?
Yeah, not quite. It's such a conflict of interest. It's just so dismaying that this department is tasked with protecting the agriculture industry, but also somehow protecting the animals that it uses to profit from. It's like mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling, and yet we don't even question it. And moreover, what's most impressive to me about the Labour animal welfare policy, believe it or not, is just that it exists. The fact that they are willing to come up forward and make this a serious discussion point in that country's political dialogue. And we had a discussion yesterday. I had an animal law class yesterday. And I had a guest speaker from Montreal, our good friend. I got to be careful. She's not a good friend of the podcast, but a good friend again. Our good friend, Alana Devine, who's the chief animal legal officer at the Montreal SPCA, where they've done so much good work. And we had a discussion that at times was very dispiriting because the last question I asked her in front of my class was, well, do you see this legislative agenda turning positive anytime soon? And she was really despondent about it, of the idea that, no, we don't see it on the horizon. The interests of the users and the industries in this country are just too strong. And I found that incredibly disappointing because I pointed out to her that in the UK, Australia, and New Zealand, it's not as if the treatment of animals is necessarily a quantum leap forward from where we are, but there's no question that the interests of animals are firmly on the legislative agenda, and we can't even propel them onto the legislative agenda here, especially at the federal level. And I think that's what the most disappointing part is of looking over this labor animal welfare policy.
Yeah, you know, it's just really mind-boggling to compare the fact that they have something on the books, and not just the Labour Party, but the governing Conservatives too. They have animal welfare policies of their own, and I believe they're even in the midst right now of some sort of crackdown on puppy mills, on commercial breeding operations. So, you know, it's not just the party of the traditional sort of left, progressives. It's even the establishment Conservatives. So we really do have a very long way to go.
Yeah, whereas, our animal welfare policy amounts to our politicians saying, everything is great. We care about the humane treatment of animals. We have great laws, nothing to do here. And it's just so frustrating and quite frankly ridiculous that no party has been able to make this a major issue. And we're still a long way, unfortunately, from getting things going. So I think, Camille, what happened there was we started out with this as a positive story. And by the end of it, I feel a bit depressed.
Whoops.
So I don't know if that worked. So let's talk about some better news. Let's talk about some better news. Alberta has had a major initiative. Is the sarcasm dripping enough from my voice?
Is it really major?
I don't know. Yeah, well, let's go with major. Alberta, a couple of weeks ago, updated their hunting regulations, and I feel obliged to point this out. Camille, Alberta has banned spears in big game hunting. So if you feel like killing a bear, you are no longer allowed to do so with a spear, Camille. And this was, and I quote, let me quote, "These changes will discourage reckless actions and ensure," you ready, Camille? This is a direct quote, "big game animals are not subjected to unnecessary suffering." So we got rid of spears. Animals in the wilderness, rejoice. You're free from spears.
So they're basically painting this as all is now fine. We've banned spears and animals aren't suffering anymore. That's...
No, Camille. They're not suffering unnecessarily. The suffering remains necessary when you use rifles, shotguns, and conventional archery gear. So no spears, but bows and arrows are cool.
Yeah, which is just amazing because bows and arrows are... from the evidence I've read, one of the worst ways for an animal to die. It's very difficult to shoot them accurately. You know, the same thing applies to a gun. But, the idea that bows and arrows are somehow not as bad as spears, I think that's on very shaky evidentiary ground. But, Peter, why did they ban spears? Do you remember?
Yeah, it's because of some guy celebrating. I've got his name right here, Josh Bomar. Ironically, Josh Bomar uses a spear. But Josh Bomar apparently killed a bear with a spear and celebrated on YouTube. So the government felt, compelled to act.
Yeah, it was a big news story.
Yeah, the quotes are hilarious. "Modernizing our hunting regulations will ensure safety and prevent game from experiencing undue suffering," said Environment Minister Shannon Phillips. I mean... I'm not convinced that any type of weapon will decide whether or not the game are actually suffering in an undue or due manner. I mean, it seems so ridiculous to me. What's amazing is that Josh Bomar gets it. Sorry, not Josh Bomar. Robert Edwards, he's a hunter. And he says, "I think they're misinformed." And essentially what he points out is there's no reason to believe that spears are any better than bows and arrows. It's just...
No.
So he points out, he's on the opposite end of this debate for me, but we tend to agree that he says it's going to set the platform to eliminate or ban other uses of weaponry. And I'm like, ta-da, that's exactly like the irrationality of it, of getting rid of spears somehow, because this somehow makes us feel better about bows, arrows, and guns. The extent to which you kill animals cleanly is actually possible in every case strikes me as wholly dependent upon the skill of the hunter and the refusal of the animal to move at the wrong moment. It's just so ludicrous.
Yeah, and you know what's really going on here is that when this Josh Bomar fellow killed a bear with a spear, and it was a pretty gruesome thing that circulated widely on YouTube and, of course, made news headlines as well, people were really outraged about it. So... the government saw an opportunity to get a little bit of political capital, I think, by banning spears and making it into kind of a feel-good news story when really nothing significant has changed. And I would say, Peter, that's the thrust of animal protection laws in Canada. It seize on a public issue that people are upset about and emotional about, do some minor thing that's not going to really make a difference for an animal, and call it a day.
Well, thanks, Camille. You've just taught my course. You know what I mean? You just essentially summed it up in a nutshell. But it's true. It is frustrating. This selective outrage runs through a lot of issues. I have a feeling we're gonna touch on selective outrage later on in our heroes and zeros topic. But it is true. It is so frustrating for us to look at this and say, well, all these issues are the same. Either you want to prevent suffering or you don't. And changing the way in which animals are killed doesn't seem to me to really get at the heart of the issue, which is suffering. Anyway.
No, it's true.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of intro and a lot of discussion about topics of the week. I think it's time, Camille, to get to our topic of the week.
Okay, so for our main segment this week, we're going to be talking about whales and dolphins in captivity in Canada. So, Peter, this has been a hot topic lately and a big area for animal justice because we've done a lot of work in it. We've intervened in a number of court cases now and supported a lot of different legislation, all aimed at getting whales and dolphins out of captivity in Canada. So I think what we really want to talk about today is just a little bit of the history of whales and dolphins in captivity in this country and where things are right now, how societal attitudes are changing and people are rising up and just saying, you know, no, that's not okay anymore. We can't keep confining these animals in tiny tanks. And then talk about some of the court cases that we've been involved with and some of the laws that municipalities, that provincial governments, and that even the federal government are looking at introducing.
Sounds good. There's no question that the issue involving whales and cetaceans in Canada has reached a hot point. There seems to be a lot of litigation going on and moves to legislate in a way that would be beneficial for animals. And there's no question we should also point out that whales are regarded around the world as very special creatures. It's somewhat easier, whether that's philosophically correct or even legally correct, to say that it's easier to act on behalf of whales than, say, I don't know, pigs or chickens.
Yeah.
Is an open question, but it's certainly the reality both in Canada and abroad.
That's right. People really do connect with whales and dolphins and cetaceans and have for many decades. And, recently in Canada and around the world, I think people have been exposed to films like Blackfish. People have seen films like The Cove that goes over whale capture and slaughter in Japan. And people, I think, are increasingly sensitized to how amazing these creatures really are and just want to see them out of tanks. So
I like to refer to it in my animal law class as the cute/impressive animal category, where I say that if only chickens were more impressive or cute, they'd have a better chance. But unfortunately, they're not. So let's just concentrate on whales for the moment.
All right. So let's go back to the 1960s, which is when orca captivity first became a thing. So the very first orca ever captured was in BC in 1965. And the first beluga whales held in captivity came from Alaska in 1967. And they were both kept at the Vancouver Aquarium, which is one of only two facilities that still has any whales and dolphins today. And from 1967 to about 1992, the government approved of the live capture of belugas and of other animals, other cetaceans, for display in Canada. And around 1992, they stopped issuing those live capture permits. But there were concerns about this whole process for as long as the practice existed. People in BC were especially concerned about capturing orcas. And this issue even filtered up to the premier of BC in 1975. He tried very, very hard to stop the transfer of an orca named Canduck, who was destined to go to Marineland. And, there was an interesting CBC article that we'll put in the show notes for this episode, but of some of the attempts that BC and Premier Dave Barrett at the time made to prevent this orca from being shipped off to captivity in Marineland. And, ultimately he was, but it really shows that this type of issue has been on people's radars for a very long time. And there's never been any societal consensus that it's okay to keep whales and dolphins in tanks. So fast forward to today, the only places that still do have cetaceans at this point are the Vancouver Aquarium in Vancouver. They only have one dolphin left at this point, and Marineland in Niagara Falls. And the West Edmonton Mall.
Marineland is a wonderful organization. I feel I should add that in right now. I feel by saying the words marine land without saying how wonderful they are, we risk a lawsuit, Camille. Anything other than marine land is great. We love it. And it's a wonderful organization that is superb to their animals. I feel like anything less than that might get us sued, Camille.
Yeah, and you can feel Peter's sarcasm coming through, but you're right.
Was that marine sarcasm, Camille?
No, not from you. Marine land is extremely litigious and has a number of open lawsuits right now against anyone virtually that's criticized their practices. So, and that, of course, stems from sort of this changing environment we're seeing in the current climate. So just, you know, kind of backtracking to about 2012, the film Blackfish came out around then, and not long before that, some whistleblowers came forward who were former trainers at Marineland, and they made some allegations of animal cruelty, of poor conditions, and things they had seen while they worked there that didn't really sit well with them. So they promptly got sued, and Blackfish comes out not long after that. Eventually, the Ontario government sees that there's an issue here. People are extremely riled up. It was a huge Toronto Star investigation based on the whistleblowers from Marineland, and it really touched a nerve with the public. So it did prompt some legislative change. And as a result of that, Ontario banned the possession and captivity of orca whales. So there's now one orca left at Marineland named Kiska, who will be the last one in captivity because it's now not legal to bring any more in. So that's...
Hooray!
So that was good news. It was a victory. It, you know, didn't change anything for any actual animals in Ontario, but it did prevent any future ones from being brought in. So that was good news. We would have liked to see that extend.
Yeah, quite frankly, I mean, that's the way we win things in Canada. We win them with time. I mean, it's the exact same thing with the elephants in zoos. It seems more and more difficult to win the battle for the existing elephants. The way you win these battles is by prohibiting any future move to do the same thing that's going on right now.
Yeah, that's right. There's not usually much of a legislative appetite to remove animals that are currently in captivity, but you can affect future ones.
Correct.
So that's the Ontario context. And out in BC, you've got Vancouver Aquarium. And people in Vancouver have not been comfortable with this whole idea of cetacean captivity for quite some time. There were moves in the 90s to try to stop it from happening. And the aquarium at that point agreed voluntarily, because it was fearful of a ban, I think, to stop capturing cetaceans from the wild. So from that point, they've only been doing sort of trades and captive breeding. And they have had a number of beluga whales over the years who've had calves. They've had a number of dolphins and porpoises as well. But I guess where the sort of the more recent Vancouver Aquarium action started to happen was late in 2016. There were two belugas left at the aquarium, Kyla and Aurora, or Kyla, I think it's actually pronounced. And they both died. They both died pretty quickly around November, early December 2016. And it wasn't really clear why they died. They became ill and they passed away pretty suddenly. The aquarium was never able to determine why they died. They said some unknown toxin was potentially ingested. And they sort of pointed the finger potentially at maybe somebody poisoning the belugas, which I thought was a veiled way to say that the animal activists did so, which of course is ridiculous, but to be expected from the aquarium industry. But what that really prompted was a lot of outrage in Vancouver, and a lot of people kind of re-energized and said, okay, this is enough. No more dead cetaceans. We don't want to see this facility confine them anymore. So let's get a municipal ban. Let's get the city of Vancouver to ban the aquarium from having any more whales and dolphins. So they did just that. They went ahead, they lobbied the Vancouver Park Board. And for listeners that need a little background on this, the Vancouver Aquarium is actually inside Stanley Park in Vancouver, which is city property. And they've got this lease with the park board to use that facility. So the park board can oversee in some regards what happens there. So it seemed reasonable that the park board could put a ban on any more whales coming into the park and breeding of the existing ones. So that happened. Okay, so that the ban came into place around May or June, was it, of 2017, and everyone was very excited about that. But why don't we back up a little bit to some of our involvement as animal justice and a few of the legal cases involving the aquarium. So, Peter, have you heard of a film?
Okay, there's been quite a few.
There have been a few. Have you heard of a film called Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered?
Amazingly, I haven't seen it, but I have heard about it, yes.
Well, Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered was a film created by filmmaker Gary Charbonneau. Mm-hmm. He's a local Vancouver guy. And he wanted to show people the reality of what captivity is like for these animals. And he wanted to sort of contrast the way the aquarium portrays itself, which is really dedicated to research and conservation, with how much money they actually spend on those activities compared to just their profit-generating or money-generating display activities of these cetaceans. So he made this film. He made it on a very shoestring budget. He raised a bit of money through crowdsourcing, but it was a very small budget film. He put his blood, sweat, and tears into it. He got a lot of amazing interviews, and he released it at public screenings. And the film, of course, is critical of keeping whales and dolphins in captivity. And the aquarium did not like that very much, let me tell you, Peter.
As they wouldn't.
No, so they sued
him. I'm sure Marineland thought about suing. Oh no, why would they do that? Well, just because.
Yeah.
Did they?
We'll get into that in a second. The Vancouver Aquarium, first what they did is they asked YouTube and Vimeo to take his documentary, which was posted for free online. They asked YouTube and Vimeo to take it down. And I believe it was YouTube said, no, we're not going to do that. You have to file a lawsuit if you want us to even consider that based on copyright infringement. So that's what they were claiming. The aquarium was saying not that this is defamatory, false information, and defamation is usually what companies use if they want to silence an activist. They usually claim defamation. Mm-hmm. That's a false statement and their reputation is suffering. But in this case,
they didn't do that. Did
they? No, they didn't do that at all. They didn't allege that there was any false information. They just said that some of the segments involved their intellectual property. So they said that Gary Charbonneau had been on their property to film, and because he'd taken pictures and images of the aquarium, that belonged to them. And they also said,
I always admire creativity in legal arguments, Camille. I feel like the creativity, they've been pretty good with creative arguments. I don't want to segue forward to where we're going with their next challenge, but I'll give them some points for creativity. Not necessarily convincing arguments, but definitely creative ones.
Yeah. And the reason, Peter, you're saying it's so creative is because this type of assertion that they would own the intellectual property that somebody else created is completely unfounded under the law. We actually have the Copyright Act, which says essentially the opposite, that the creator of a work is the owner of that work. So they were saying that they owned footage that Gary Charbonneau took. They were saying that they owned all these other photos that different photographers had taken that they didn't own at all, like Joanne MacArthur, the animal rights photographer. She was the owner of some of them. But they applied for an injunction. And they managed to get that injunction ordering the removal of a bunch of segments of this film. So when we saw that, we were pretty disturbed. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just going to backtrack for a quick second. This whole idea of using copyright law and intellectual property law, I think it was actually something that Marineland pioneered. And you asked if they thought of suing, and I think maybe it was their idea initially.
I had to know that Marineland was involved somehow, Somewhere, somehow, Marineland was involved.
Well, the interesting...
If there's litigation going on involving animals, Marineland must be involved.
They have been involved.
Wait a minute. They might sue me for that, Camille.
They might.
Was that defamatory? Go ahead. Yes, sorry.
No offense taken. Intended, rather. But they sent a letter to a billboard company about less than a year prior to this case, alleging that a billboard in the Niagara Falls region that had photos that may have been taken at Marineland was in violation of copyright law and should be taken down. So you start to see the seeds of this legal strategy being planted sometime before it actually came out.
Right.
And Marineland eventually did sue a student filmmaker from California who made sort of a reflective documentary that was going to be released, hadn't actually been released yet, but a trailer came out and there was footage of Kiska, the orca at Marineland, that somebody, we don't know who, had taken. So they had this letter about the billboard. They had this other case against this 19-year-old student filmmaker. And then lo and behold, the aquarium case comes along in Vancouver. So that goes to court. The first instance judge at the injunction, she does order the removal of those segments, which a lot of legal experts were really concerned about that decision based on principles of intellectual property law. So Gary Charbonneau and his lawyers, Arden Beddoes and Ben Oliphant, good friends of animal justice, they decide to appeal to the BC Court of Appeal, which grants leave to appeal. And animal justice, we decide at that point to intervene. And the point that we wanted to make was that if you let aquariums, if you let other industries silence the creators and the criticizers of these practices based on copyright law at the injunction stage of litigation, that's going to have a huge muzzling effect on people who report on animal cruelty and try to get publicity and attention and charges laid. And Peter...
Yeah, the spinoff impact for that is enormous. I mean, it has the potential to shut down all sorts of undercover investigations. Any case in which you're photographing or trying to document a practice, you can get shut down on using copyright law, which seems, frankly, ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's especially concerning at the injunction stage. Do you want to just explain to listeners what an injunction is and what the difference is between an injunction and a main legal action?
Well, an injunction shuts down, it's an order effectively that shuts down your ability and requires an immediate cessation or termination of whatever it is that you're doing. So it stops it before the actual merits of the action have been heard. It's supposed to be an extremely rare remedy that's only given out in cases where, you know, there's a clear evidentiary basis and there's no other way to prevent the harm that's taking place. So you need to have injunctions in our society, but it seems to be very clear that they should be given out on a very, very rare basis.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the key here is that it gets given out and someone is ordered to stop doing something before the merits of the case have been heard. So before there's a full trial on the merits, before all the evidence can be presented, there's a test for an injunction that involves a few different stages. But the key is that it happens early in the process and eventually could be reversed if a trial judge finds something else. So it's a pretty extreme remedy. And that's why it was so concerning. So this case goes to the Vancouver Court of Appeal and the BC Court of Appeal. And happily, they agreed with most of Gary Charbonneau's arguments and they reversed the injunction. So now he's allowed to have those 15 segments back in the film. And they said some really important things about the need to consider free speech in the context of an injunction, which really addressed our concerns. And I was really happy that animal justice actually did get a shout out in the judge's reasons because interveners don't always get that. But clearly they did think that we had something important to say about addressing animal cruelty concerns. And the court was really worried about just making sure that no one's free speech was silenced at an injunction stage. So that was a good decision, and it was the outcome that we wanted.
Right on. Nice work. Who are our lawyers on that, Camille?
We were represented by a great guy from Vancouver named Brian McLean. So
shout out to Brian McLean. Thanks for your hard work.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. Thank you, Brian. And so that was a good outcome. That case came out last November, so pretty recent. All right, so... where are we? That's not all.
But that's not all. We've got new cases, Camille. Remember that the park board ban goes also before a British Columbia Supreme Court judge.
That's right. So while this copyright case is ongoing, the park board bans whales and dolphins at the park, which is great. And then, of course, not long after, the aquarium files a judicial review application for that decision, and they want it struck down. And they say a whole bunch of things. They say, okay, we had a contract with the city, and the contract said that the city's not going to interfere in our day-to-day operations. So for you guys to come in here and impose this whale and dolphin ban, that's not permitted under the contract. So that was one argument. Another argument, there was some noise made about procedural fairness and whether they had a full opportunity to be heard during this process of the park board considering imposing a ban, which I never thought was really going to go anywhere. And then the third argument is the real kicker, Peter. This is the one that we were especially concerned with. And it was the aquarium saying that their free speech rights, protected under Canada's Charter of Rights, were violated by this ban because, Peter, get this, they could no longer communicate with the public that they thought it was okay to display whales by not displaying them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Those arguments are the kind we raise eyebrows about and say, sounds unusual. That's legal speak for batshit crazy, but we're going to go with unusual. The idea that the display of animals somehow amounts to expression that needs to be protected rather than the actual expression itself. Of course, if you want to communicate that you think whales should be kept in captivity in this way, that's very easy to do without actually having to keep the whales in captivity. But apparently that distinction did not occur to the lawyers representing the aquarium in this case.
No, no. And there's a lot of case law that goes against what they're saying already. Like, for instance, the Supreme Court has considered this kind of expression issue in the context of tobacco advertising and sales. And they've said, you know, it is expression to be advertising a product, but the sale of a product that's restricted, that's not expression. That's something else.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It makes sense, right?
Yeah, it was a pretty far-fetched argument to begin with, but I mean, we had to get involved to point out how far-fetched it was, because again, the ramifications, if it was accepted even by a lower court judge, were huge. It was not something that we could countenance, because again, it would tend to protect a wide variety of conduct involving animals, where we're not even clear exactly how broad, and it would give it constitutional protection, which is just very, very troublesome.
Oh, it's pretty extreme, but you can easily imagine a ruling, if it went the wrong way, being used to strike down virtually any ban on animal captivity or any restrictions on animal use in some way, if it was accepted that using animals and displaying them was free speech. And just, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that there was a concerning case out of Ontario a number of years ago involving a Windsor, which banned circuses. And the circus industry got that ban struck down on the basis that circus performances did engage freedom of expression issues. So there was a bit of precedent for this. It wasn't in another province, and it was a different context, because circus performances may involve some sort of expressive activity in a way that just confining animals wouldn't necessarily. But there was enough of a concern there that we knew we had to get involved. So we had brilliant lawyers in this case. The same dynamic duo, we could say, that represented Gary Charbonneau, the Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered filmmaker. It was Arden Beddoes and Benjamin Oliphant. So good friends of animal justice, good friends of mine from law school. They represented us in this intervention, and they came up with an argument that we thought was really important to advance. And what we said, we intervened exclusively on the basis of the free expression argument that the aquarium was making. We said that it's well recognized in Canadian law that expression doesn't protect violent activity or communications intimately connected with violence. So what does that mean? Well, my favorite example of this is the provision in the criminal code against making a death threat. So Peter, I can't threaten to kill you. And of course, if I do so, I'm engaging in expression and it's speech. But the law doesn't support or recognize that as legitimate speech that should be protected, because it's violent. And we don't, as a society, want to encourage or allow violence in this way. And we want to restrict it.
Right.
So what we said in this case, in our intervention, was that it's actually violent as well to confine these sentient, intelligent, just incredible animals in tiny tanks where they inevitably suffer. It's a very violent activity for them and not something that they should endure. And even if this were to be considered expression, just the act of confining them, it should not be countenanced by the state, because it involves violence and suffering.
Yeah.
So that was our argument. I really liked it and thought it was important. The case dragged on for a kind of a while. It started off in September of last year, wrapped up in December. And we got the decision on February 9th. And, you know, funny enough, I mentioned earlier, I was at this legal symposium in Denver, and I was talking about aquarium cases. I was talking about this one in particular. And the night before, we got word that this decision would be coming out. So I was kind of amending my presentation on the fly after we got it.
Always good timing when that happens.
Yeah, it was kind of cool to be able to talk about it at least. But it wasn't the outcome.
It's kind of a win some, lose some type of decision, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It wasn't the outcome we wanted, because the judge did agree with the aquarium's first claim. The judge said, no, the Parks Board can't enact this ban with respect to you, because you do have a contract with the city that says that they won't interfere in the day-to-day operations of the aquarium. So it was struck down or as inapplicable to the Vancouver Aquarium on that basis, until the contract expires basically in 2029. So that's the bad news, but there was some good news. The good news is that the court didn't consider any of the other arguments, and certainly not the free speech one, and it didn't enshrine anything unhelpful into the law. So we sort of dodged that bullet.
Right. I want to touch on this issue of contracts and the way in which they affect animal interests, because I think there's a really important lesson here. really, I think it's a lesson that goes to accepting compromises where animal welfare is concerned. Because what this court case recognizes is that the aquarium had a legitimate financial interest in running things the way it had been promised they could run them. And that's what happens when we turn over decisions of animal welfare to groups that, you know, don't necessarily have the best interests of animal welfare at heart. And more importantly, regardless of how you feel about that, the way in which a contract enshrines the rights of the property holder is really, really troublesome, because what we can see is it takes a long time to be able to overcome these contractual rights that have been agreed to. So a comparable example of something that I remember dealing with when I lived in New Zealand was there was a lot of discussion about how we should move animal welfare reform forward for chickens. And one of the questions was whether or not we should move to the enriched cage. That was the move away from battery cages to slightly larger enriched cages. And one of the reasons I was so adamantly against this, even though it would confer some sort of notional welfare benefit to the animals, was that I recognized that any time that industry invests in a major cost initiative, it's incredibly difficult to overcome. You're essentially stuck with this for 15 to 20 years, which is exactly what we see in this case. Once you grant the aquarium license to do a particular thing and you sign a contract to that effect, that contract is either going to require an extremely expensive payout, or it's going to allow them to continue doing what they're doing, even if we subsequently discover that those things are not acceptable. So in the case of the enriched cages, I knew that once you accepted that an industry was willing to invest billions of dollars or millions of dollars in enriched cages, those enriched cages were going to be around for a very, very long time. And that is one of the costs we see when deals are made with animal industries that allow them to create. They essentially, create economic incentives to continue going the exact same way we've been going. So this is another troubling example of how contracts of this sort can be problematic for animals.
Definitely, definitely. Now, the good news about this situation is that the aquarium actually, even before the decision came out, was sort of forced into abandoning whale and dolphin captivity on its own. So on January 19th, over a month ago now, they announced that they would just end that practice. And they only have one dolphin left alive at the aquarium. They've just been dropping like flies over the last year. So,
and that was just because of public pressure. Is that correct, Camille? That's not any...
It was public pressure. No, it wasn't even the court case. It was surprising to me that they actually came out with a decision before the court ruling came out, but it was entirely due to public pressure. And I think ultimately, their bottom line. They even said that they were losing donations, they were losing ticket and admission sales because of this, and they were trying to bill it as, oh, it's just the controversy. People don't like the controversy. But I think what's really going on here is people are just saying, yeah, we're not going to go to this aquarium that continues to keep cetaceans in captivity because that's not in step with societal values anymore.
Right.
So ultimately...
Right. Let's just keep fish in captivity. That's much, much better. Oh, wait. Yeah.
Well, that's right. And they have tons of marine mammals still and all kinds of other fish and aquatic animals. So it's certainly no paradise there. But there was a huge victory in that we forced them to give up on cetaceans.
Okay, Camille. And that's not all. There is more on the news front involving cetaceans. I believe that our government, which has not done much to get involved with animal welfare in any way, we shouldn't say they've been completely bankrupt, because there is a bill moving through the Senate involving cetaceans. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah. So this bill is called S-203. It was first introduced by Senator Wilfred Moore. I believe it was in 2015, not long after, or maybe it was even before the last federal election, but it was introduced some time ago. It was reintroduced after the election, and it's been winding its way through the Senate ever since. It went to the stage of having committee hearings, and the committee heard from just dozens and dozens of experts, both in support of this bill and opposed to the bill. Now, the bill would ban keeping cetaceans in captivity. It would make it a criminal offense to do so. It would also ban the import, export of cetaceans and their reproductive materials so that you couldn't have artificial insemination, for instance. And it would make it sure that no one can capture a cetacean from the wild as well. So really important stuff. And after it finally got out of the Senate committee and there was a 9-5 vote in favor of the bill at the committee, it's been stalled now on the floor of the Senate ever since. So everyone's trying to get this bill to a vote, but there's one senator in particular, Senator Don Platt from Manitoba, who is extremely opposed to it. He's the conservative Senate whip, and for whatever reason, just loves Marineland, loves Vancouver Aquarium. He's doing everything he can to delay this bill procedurally, including some pretty unprecedented tactics. So there's a lot of effort being made to keep pushing and keep getting it up for a vote. We do expect that it will pass the Senate when it gets to a vote, which I hope is going to be soon. And then it would go over to the House of Commons. So this has been going on for a while. But Peter, what you're referencing, or another aspect to what you're referencing, is the fact that the government's also paying attention to this. So
S-203, I bet they are. Yeah.
Oh, they are. S-203 is a private Senate bill, but the government recently introduced changes to the Fisheries Act and a lot of stuff about fish habitat protection. But one thing that they snuck in there was some positive measures for whales and dolphins, too. So they said that there would be an explicit ban on the wild capture of whales and dolphins for display, except that there was a bit of a loophole that might leave them room in some circumstances, which I don't love, but whatever, it's there. And they would
if we get that bill, Camille, we don't need S-203 anymore, correct?
Well, that's the concern. That's the concern. And the problem with what the government's proposing is that it would affect import-export and it would affect capturing wild animals for display, but it wouldn't affect all the animals still in captivity right now. They could still be kept there and they could also still be bred in captivity. So frankly, what we really need is a breeding ban, and that's missing from this bill. So I'm really concerned that this is just going to replace Bill S-203 and we won't get those important measures that we actually do need.
Yeah, that is a concern.
Yeah, so we all have to keep the pressure up. This is still very early in the process. We still have a couple years to go before the next election. There is still time to get measures passed by then. So we need to be contacting our members of parliament, contacting senators, contacting the government and the fisheries minister, Dominic LeBlanc, and telling them that we need a complete ban on cetacean captivity. So that's kind of the state of the legislative affairs. And Peter, there's one more cool thing. Have you heard of the Whale Sanctuary Project?
I've heard a little bit about it. I know my colleague Cameron Jeffries, professor here at the University of Alberta Faculty of Law, is very excited about it, but that's all I've heard about it. What can you tell us?
Well, it's pretty exciting, but there's a group in the States called the Whale Sanctuary Project that's pushing to build a seaside sanctuary for whales and dolphins rescued from the aquarium industry. So the basic idea is that you would net off a really big cove, and that could be a home for whales and dolphins that can't be returned to the wild because they don't have the social skills or the hunting skills and the life skills that they need tragically to sustain themselves because they've spent their lives in miserable captivity. And
great idea.
Great idea. Sanctuaries, you know, are an amazing option for animals that can't return to the wild. And what's especially exciting about the Whale Sanctuary Project for Canada is that two of the sites they're considering are A, on Vancouver Island, and B, in Nova Scotia. So it could end up that we even have the sanctuary in our own country, which would be pretty exciting.
That would be amazing. But, you know, Marineland has to be involved in some way in this. I feel that there. No, I can't say any more about Marineland. Let's just leave Marineland out of this going forward. Well, this is a lot to digest involving whales and dolphins. As you can probably tell, this is not my area of expertise. I've let Camille carry the ball on this one because with the exception of a few of the issues involved in the BC Court of Appeal case on free expression, I am not an expert on whales and cetaceans. So it's informative for me to learn so much about where we are. There's definitely some exciting litigation going on here and some exciting prospect for legislation. So it's something that Pawn Order will keep close tabs on going forward.
Definitely. And you know, what's exciting about us about this to us is that the reason we see so much activity, litigation, legislation is that society is ready for this change. People are saying no more whale and dolphin captivity. And when society is ready for something, it's our job as animal lawyers to step in there and make sure that we have the right laws, that we have the right court decisions to get that into place and make it the law of the land.
Absolutely.
So stay tuned.
Heroes and Zeros.
All right. And now our favorite segment, Heroes and Zeros.
It's everybody's favorite segment, isn't it, Camille? We don't know that yet. Well, I just like saying that. Everybody's favorite segment.
If it is your favorite segment, email us and tell us because we'd be curious to know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Peter, who is our hero this week?
Well, our hero this week is one that's very close to my heart. I think Camille's heart, and I think every law student who's ever taken animal law, especially if you were taking animal law coming up during the darker days of the late 90s or the early 2000s. And we are giving our hero of the month to the Animal Legal Defense Fund. And the reason we're doing that, it's in conjunction. The Animal Legal Defense Fund is holding its National Justice for Animals Week this week. And that is a way in which they raise awareness about animal abuse, how to report it, and how to work with communities to create stronger laws. So they've been doing this for a long time. The first one was way back in 2009, and it's a week in which they really try to bring public awareness forward for animals. And I think in and of itself, that's a great thing that is deserving of hero status. But frankly, I want to go a little bit deeper and talk just a little bit about the Animal Legal Defense Fund and the role that they played really in getting, I think, all of us started. The truth was, when I first began working in this field and thinking about animal law issues, I don't think I would have gone anywhere without the Animal Legal Defense Fund. We were a small group of people who were interested in the issues way out in New Zealand. And frankly, we drew inspiration and ideas about what we were going to do, not to mention a lot of like reading material from the Animal Legal Defense Fund. And they were the first group that was really able to focus on legal issues for animals and really develop themselves in a way that allowed others to come on board. And frankly, I think every single animal law-related group in the world is to some extent thankful and owing a debt of gratitude to the Animal Legal Defense Fund.
Yeah, I agree. When I was a student at University of Toronto, my colleague Anna Pippis and I were co-presidents of the Student Animal Legal Defense Fund Club, and they just did tremendous work to provide grants to students to travel to conferences, to help us with speaker panel ideas and movie night ideas, and ensure that we could educate the broader animal or the broader student community about the issues as well. So I've always really appreciated them. We still work closely with them to this day, and hats off to them for all they've done to support this field, both in the US, in Canada, and of course, these days globally.
Hear, hear. Great job by the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Now, Camille, not everyone's a hero. Oh, this is a very special zero. I believe it's one that is close to your heart and the heart of many Canadians. Who is our zero, Camille?
Well, it's close to my broken heart. God, it's just such an awful story. But zero this week goes to the BC couple who adopted a pot-bellied pig named Molly from the local branch of the SPCA. And then instead of giving her a loving forever home, like I'm sure she was expecting, they butchered and they ate her flesh. And they Snapchatted photos of themselves doing so and broadcast those across the internet of them seasoning Molly before eating her body. So,
Camille, I have to say, let me interrupt for 1 second to say that there are times at which it is really a challenge for us, or it is hard for us to decide who our zero of the episode is going to be. It posed no such difficulty this week. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say. It was pretty obvious.
In fact, I'd say this is our zero of the year so far. When we have our awards at the end of the year, the idiot couple, and I feel free to say idiot couple that decided to adopt a pig and then eat it for dinner is just about the zero of the, likely to be the zero of the year. Early front runner.
Early front runner for sure. I'd be surprised if somebody topped it, but then again, I'm constantly surprised at the depths people will go to abuse animals, so maybe I shouldn't be. But
I don't know. I think there's room. There's always room.
Yeah, but this case is.
I mean, Robert Sopuck has all year to go.
Oh yeah, that's
right.
That's...
Oh, sorry. Did I do that?
Yeah. Google
okay,
Robert.
Let's leave it there. Right. Let's go back to our couple.
All right. So they adopted Molly. They killed and they ate her, and of course, people are outraged. So the number one question that all the online commenters are asking is, "Oh my God, why haven't charges been laid? We should prosecute these people for animal cruelty," and. The answer, unfortunately, is that you can't prosecute somebody for killing an animal that they lawfully own. The law does not protect animals' lives. It does not give them the right to their own lives. It only protects them from unnecessary suffering or distress. So if they had tortured Molly first, sure, that would be a problem, but they're allowed to lawfully to kill an animal that they lawfully own as long as they're not causing distress or suffering. So the SPCA did attend the home. They did some investigation into the manner of killing, and they determined that that they had no basis to lay charges. So unfortunately, that's kind of it. But a lot of people, Peter, I think, are just really surprised to learn. It doesn't occur to them that you can actually just kill an animal that you own for any reason whatsoever, including not just pigs, but a cat or a dog as well.
Well, why not, right? I mean, that's the way the property paradigm works. And of course, there was really nothing the SPCA could do about that. Law students in their very first year in law school learn very quickly that it is very, very difficult, if not impossible, to put restraints on property. You can't create various restraints on the way in which a transfer of property, and this pig was very clearly property, is going to be carried out. So there was really nothing the SPCA could do aside from, I don't know, perhaps putting in more strict adoption procedures in the first place and properly screening out this nutcase couple that had no sense of what they were doing and frankly no sense of propriety or dignity. But in any event, there was nothing they could do. They can't put a clause in a contract, say you will not cook and eat this pig, you stupid morons. Like they couldn't do that. It is not possible to put those types of restrictions in place.
Now, they do make people agree not to kill and eat the animals that they're adopting, especially if they're farmed animals like chickens or pot-bellied pigs, which we eat their cousins. But the remedy for somebody doing that is that the SPCA can go in and seize that animal and take the animal back if they're being mistreated. But in this case, of course, Molly's already dead. So there's nothing that they can do to help her anymore. She's gone. So, you know, a lot of people have been upset with the SPCA over this, too. And I would say don't blame them. It's not their fault that our laws, frankly, are out of step with the way we think about animals. And Peter, I wrote a piece in the Globe and Mail about this yesterday that's been getting a lot of positive response and saying, look, the fact that people are so outraged about this really speaks to this idea that we're really uncomfortable with treating animals just like pure property. They're not tables and chairs. We shouldn't be able to just dispose of them as we want to. So let's start having this conversation. Let's make sure legislators hear about this. It might be an uncomfortable discussion to have, but it's one that we need to have because it's 2018. The last time we updated our animal cruelty laws was in the 50s, and the law has changed.
Absolutely. Well, that's our heroes and zeros for today. But again, some real good ones on both ends. We're always looking forward to finding more examples of, well, lots of heroes, but unfortunately, a few zeros as well.
Yeah, send them our way. Okay, and with that, I guess we'll transition into our Q&A segment.
We got some good questions from a few of our listeners, and we wanted to touch on them today. I'll read out the first one to you. It's from Neil Morrison. And Camille, he asks, since corporations have legal standing as persons in Canada, what lessons, if any, can be drawn from that towards advancing the concept of personhood for animals in the courts?
Yeah, great question, Neil. Thanks for asking it. Corporations are considered legal persons under the law in Canada and in the US and many other jurisdictions as well. So they have standing and the ability to go to court. What is really interesting about this is that animals do not have standing. They do not have the ability to go to court on their own. But if there's a lesson that I think that we can draw from this whole system, I mean, first of all, it doesn't really ring true to a lot of people that corporations are considered persons and go to court, but animals can't. But at the same time, corporations and animals are both considered legal property right now. And I think that goes to show that, you know, maybe property could still be property, but also have standing to go to court, which I think would be potentially a less seismic shift for society and the law to consider when we talk about how to give animals better protections. Maybe they stay property, but we also give them standing for a while and see how that works out. So, I think the idea that an entity is either a person or property maybe is not quite the right way to look at it, but perhaps they can be persons and also property in some contexts, and maybe we could use that paradigm to help animals. So that's a philosophical discussion, and Peter, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, well, I think you've got it right on. I don't think they're exactly or directly analogous, but I do think at the same time that it's a helpful way of thinking about things. And the fact that corporations have standing and are treated as legal persons is something we can think about that's useful to construct alternative legal mechanisms or alternative ways of thinking about what animals actually are. So I think that's useful. The reason I say I don't think they're directly analogous is that the reason that corporations have standing and the reason they're treated as persons is not directly translatable to animals. animals. There are very good reasons why we need to have corporations as legal entities. And those are usually for economic purposes that are not translatable to animals. So the rationale is not directly translatable, but the idea of being willing to shift our thinking of what persons can be is, of course, useful, perhaps in future discussions involving animals.
It's all about creativity.
Any more questions, Camille?
Yeah, so we do have another one from Marta, who's asking, how can citizens influence lawmakers? What actions have the most impact? Is it protests, petitions, phone calls, letters? And who in Canadian politics are some of the key animal rights supporters? So Marta, I love this question because I'm always on about how we all as citizens need to get politically active if we're going to make any change. We spoke earlier about the fact that the Labour Party in the UK has such an incredible animal welfare platform. That's not an accident. It's not just because they're doing it because it's the right thing to do. It's because the public expects it there, and it's because Labour Party activists have demanded it and worked internally for decades. We need to do that in Canada. So what I tell everybody is develop a relationship with your member of parliament, with your member of provincial parliament, and with your city councillor. Meet with these people, explain to them the issues that you care about, pick a few priorities, and bring some people with you. Bring other constituents with you. Show them that it's not just you in their riding that's concerned about this, but there is a groundswell of people. So a meeting is the best way. And I sometimes go to these meetings with constituents. I went to one the other week with a local Ottawa woman who wanted to meet with her MP and wanted some help there and then a bit of expertise. And I went, and it's a great experience. Legislators are often really keen to hear about their constituents' concerns. And when you explain to them what the issues are, sometimes they really get it. So I encourage you to do this. It can be a lot of fun and really gratifying. If you can't have a meeting, a phone call is your next best bet. A handwritten letter is great. An email is great. Send a petition. And in terms of federal politics right now, there are members of all parties who are supportive of these issues. Nathaniel Erskine-Smith from the Liberals is certainly among the most prominent because he did put forward an animal protection bill. But even in the Conservatives, even in the NDP, there are people, and of course, Green Party leader Elizabeth May is a huge supporter of animal rights. There are people who get it. So our task is to make sure that more people get it, that more MPs listen to these issues, and you can do that by building a relationship with them.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have too much to add to that. I think those are the key points in terms of influencing lawmakers. The only other thing I'll add is that if you want to influence lawmakers, your actions speak louder than any words, in my opinion. Lawmakers respond to trends that are going on in society, and I have found that some of the most effective means for animal law advancement has been through direct consumer action that has affected groups that then, of course, influence lawmakers. Lawmakers are not oblivious to what is going on in society, and the more we can do at every level to show how things are happening, the more that lawmakers will respond to them.
Great point. Okay, thank you for those questions. If you want a question answered in a future Paw and Order episode, please email us info@animaljustice.ca, and we'll be happy to talk about your question on the air.
We look forward to it. We'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in. Please, a reminder, you can subscribe to the Paw and Order podcast using iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcatcher. And please, please leave us a rating and a review, which helps us reach more people.
You can also share the podcast so that others have the opportunity to listen to it. And we always welcome donations to Animal Justice, which makes Paw and Order possible.
You can find me on Twitter at Peter Sankoff, on Facebook at Professor Sankoff, and at my website, petersankoff.com.
And you can find me online on Twitter at Camille Labchuk, same handle on Instagram. And we always enjoy Twitter conversations about the show or any other animal law or political topics. And finally, thank you so much to our producer, Shannon Milling.
See you next time on Paw and Order.